Welcome back. It's season three of Employment Law Matters, the go-to podcast for HR professionals and employment lawyers. I'm Barrister Daniel Barnett, and I've got 10 fantastic episodes all lined up for you over the next few weeks, over Christmas and into the new year. New episodes drop every Tuesday. In this series, we're covering topics such as the menopause. I'll be talking with Amanda Stedman of BDBF Solicitors about what sort of workplace problems can arise in connection with the menopause, what legal protections menopausal workers have, and what should good employers do to support menopausal workers. Views from a regional employment judge. I spent an hour chewing over the world's problems with a regional employment judge. You'll learn about a typical day in their life, what happened to their region during COVID, and how they deal with complaints about employment judges. Post-termination restrictive covenants. The only person in the UK who can make restrictive covenants interesting talks to me about what they are and how to enforce them. Long COVID and occupational health. Why does it need to be on an employer's radar, and how do you help those with long COVID return to work? I'll also be talking about a few subjects myself, giving mini lectures if you would. In fact, that's what I'm doing in this episode, when I'll answer the question, what is a reasonable adjustment? That's coming up in a couple of minutes. In other episodes this season, I talk about what is a repudiatory breach and when does TUPE apply. We've also got an episode where I've asked back Michael Salter from 42 Bedford Row, whose interview with me last year on 10 misconceptions about an employment tribunal was our most listened to episode. He's giving another top 10 list, his top 10 tips for case management hearings later in the season. Season 3 of Employment Law Matters is supported by our two sponsors, Watson Ramsbottom Solicitors in Lancashire and occupational health expert Dr. Sarangi of coverclinic.com.
Welcome to Employment Law Matters with Barrister Daniel Barnett.
The duty to make reasonable adjustments is triggered if an employee or a job applicant meets the definition of disability contained in the Equality Act 2010. The employee has to have a physical or mental impairment which has a substantial and long-term adverse effect on their ability to carry out normal day-to-day activities. The law requires an employer to treat a disabled employee more favourably than it treats disabled colleagues in order to reduce or remove any substantial disadvantage caused by the combination of the individual's disability and elements of the workplace or job. The aim of the law is to eliminate barriers that stop disabled people participating in work on an equal basis to others. Now, there's a common misconception that disabled employees can ask for any changes they like and say they are reasonable adjustments. I'd like a pay rise, please. It's a reasonable adjustment. I'd like three times as much office space. I'd like to be paid my full salary even though I'm on long-term sick. It's a reasonable adjustment. But the reality is somewhat different. The duty to make reasonable adjustments only arises in specific circumstances, and the requirement, of course, is to make reasonable adjustments, not any and all adjustments. Section 20 of the Equality Act 2010 sets out the duty on employers to make reasonable adjustments for disabled employees or job applicants. The duty arises where an individual is disabled within the definition of disability and is placed at a substantial disadvantage by either an employer's provision, criterion, or practice, that's just something the employer requires or tends to do, or by a physical feature of the employer's workplace or premises, for example, stairs, or an employer's failure to provide an auxiliary aid. The test, the legal test, involves a comparison exercise between the effect of the provision, criterion, or practice, or the physical feature on the employee, and the effect it has on people who are not disabled. The duty to make reasonable adjustments does not arise unless a substantial disadvantage for the disabled person is established. A substantial disadvantage isn't actually as hard to establish as it sounds. It's one that's more than minor or trivial. It's not a particularly high bar for an employee to reach. If an employee does suffer substantial disadvantage, then the employer has to make reasonable adjustments to alleviate that disadvantage. It's the employment tribunal's job to decide whether a particular adjustment would have been reasonable for the employer to make in the circumstances. A tribunal will take into account relevant matters such as whether the adjustment would have reduced or removed the disadvantage, the cost of making the adjustment, bearing in mind the employer's financial resources, and the disruption that the adjustments would have on the employer's activities. And tribunals often find that particular adjustments are disproportionate and therefore not reasonable if the costs are excessive when compared with the employer's size and financial resources. Also, the requirement to make reasonable adjustments only arises if the employer knows or ought reasonably to know that the employee is disabled and likely to be placed at a substantial disadvantage because of their disability. But if there is a duty to make a reasonable adjustment and the employer fails to make it, it can never be justified. There's no justification defence. Let's have a think about what are physical features of the employer's premises. I gave the example of a staircase a moment ago, but it's a very wide definition. It includes any feature of a building stemming from its design or its build, or a feature of the approach to a building, its exit points, its entrance points, its fixtures, its fittings, its furnishings. And if any physical features of a building cause disadvantage, reasonable adjustments might include removing the physical feature in question. For example, removing a rug which impedes a wheelchair user. It might involve altering the physical feature in question, such as widening doors to accommodate a wheelchair. Or it might include providing a reasonable means of avoiding the hazard. Let me give you an example. Take an office building which has internal doors with clear glass panels. This physical feature places the visually impaired at a substantial disadvantage when compared with people who don't have a visual disability. The duty to make reasonable adjustments arises, and the employer must take reasonable steps to remove or reduce that disadvantage. Now, depending on the financial resources, that might involve a complete reglazing of the clear see-through glass panels so as to avoid any real risk at all of the visually impaired person not realizing there's a panel there. Or it could involve something as simple as adding coloured stickers to the clear glass to make the hazard stand out. I mentioned auxiliary aids. I'm going to come to provision criteria or practices in a moment because that's the most common situation when reasonable adjustments arise, but let me just deal with auxiliary aids as well. An auxiliary aid is something which provides support or assistance to someone with a disability. Often, it's a specialist piece of equipment. Common auxiliary aids are adapted keyboards or voice-activated software for those with visual impairments. The definition can also include auxiliary services, such as a sign language interpreter for someone with a hearing impairment. If you've ever come to any of my masterclasses, you may have seen that on occasion I have two sign language interpreters at the front in order to help a member of the audience who is hearing impaired. That's a reasonable adjustment I've made in the past for attendees at my masterclasses. But I'll give you a more real-life example. Imagine James. James is an administrative assistant who has arthritis. His employer might need to consider a specially adapted keyboard to help James do his job. That specialist keyboard is an auxiliary aid. If it's reasonable to provide the keyboard, if it's not disproportionately expensive, and if the absence of a keyboard places James at a substantial disadvantage compared with non-disabled people, those who don't have arthritis, then the duty to make reasonable adjustments will require the employer to provide that keyboard. Let's come then to PCPs, provision, criterion, or practice. The acronym can cause headaches in even the brightest legal minds, and it can totally flummox a layperson. The term provision, criterion, or practice, PCP, isn't defined in law, so its ambit is regularly argued out in the courts. Now, the term PCP, provision, criterion, or practice, is deliberately broad to achieve the legislation's aim of reducing or eliminating disadvantage for people with disabilities. The definition includes any formal or informal employment workplace policies or rules or practices or arrangements, qualifications. It can even include some one-off decisions or actions. Let's go through an example. An employer has a policy of giving designated car parking spaces only to senior managers. Clara is a more junior employee with impaired mobility, which meets the definition of disability. She says she needs to park closer to the office. Does the duty to make reasonable adjustments arise? So what's the provision, criterion, or practice? Well, in this case, the PCP is the employer's parking policy. It's the employer's policy that says, if you're not a senior manager, you've got to walk a long way between your car, where you've parked your car, and the office. What's the substantial disadvantage? Clara can't easily walk longer distances from the car to the office, whereas someone without a disability can do so easily. This disadvantage isn't minor or trivial, and therefore it qualifies, it counts as a substantial disadvantage. And that means the duty to make reasonable adjustments is triggered. It is likely to be a reasonable adjustment to the employer's car parking policy to give Clara a designated parking space, and the failure to do so may give rise to a successful claim for failure to make reasonable adjustments. Let's turn now to common issues and adjustments that crop up regularly in the workplace. With several years' sustained rapid growth and experts covering a full range of legal services, Watson Ramsbottom Solicitors are becoming a name you need to be aware of. From their roots in Lancashire, they've grown across into Yorkshire and are now taking instructions nationwide. Visit watsonramsbottom.com for more information. Watson Ramsbottom Solicitors. Whatever your legal issue, they've got your back. What common issues and adjustments crop up regularly in the workplace? I'm going to run through three. The issue of additional equipment, it's very short. The issue of sickness absence, and the issue of employees who are no longer able to do the job. Let's cover additional equipment. It's very, very straightforward. Let's say Laura has a visual impairment. She can't read small text or use a standard keyboard. The physical features of her workplace place her at a substantial disadvantage when compared with non-disabled co-workers because she can't do most of the tasks associated with her job. The duty to make reasonable adjustments arises, and the employer might need to provide specialist equipment to help Laura, including a larger screen and voice recognition software to remove or reduce the disadvantage. As I said, additional equipment is the most straightforward. Let's turn to sickness absence. Disabled employees are more likely than others to have increased levels of sickness absence, but the requirement to make reasonable adjustments doesn't mean that an employer has to ignore disability-related absence completely when managing the absence of disabled employees. Example, Anna has depression, which results in high levels of sickness absence. Her employer has made all other reasonable adjustments for Anna to help her with her absence. The requirement for consistent attendance at work is a provision criterion or practice, which puts Anna at a substantial disadvantage when compared with non-disabled employees. Therefore, the duty to make reasonable adjustments is triggered. Now, before taking any kind of disciplinary action, the employer should refer Anna to occupational health to get up-to-date medical advice on prognosis and on whether any other adjustments can improve attendance. The employer should consider other options, such as adjustments to Anna's role. The employer should consider the impact of Anna's absence on the team and on service levels before taking any disciplinary action. The employer should follow their own absence management policies and consider adjustments to any trigger points for action. Come back to that in a second. And finally, the employer should consider how and whether disciplinary action will help the employer to achieve their objectives in achieving consistent attendance for Anna. Now, Anna's employer has to make reasonable adjustments to the way it applies its absence management process, including issuing warnings for absence. That doesn't mean warnings can't be issued, but some flexibility is necessary, tailored to Anna's case. It might be appropriate in some cases not to issue warnings or to adopt more lenient trigger points. Relaxing trigger points might not always be a reasonable adjustment, though. For example, if Anna is likely to have long periods of absence in the future, a short extension to a trigger point is unlikely to remove any disadvantage. On the other hand, if her periods of absence are likely to be short in the future, this kind of adjustment might well be a reasonable one. When applying the absence policy, it might be a reasonable adjustment to disregard reasonable absence linked to an employee's particular disability over an average year. Or it might be going too far and be disproportionate and unreasonable. It is all very fact sensitive, which in practice, unfortunately, means that a employer might come to a decision that's objectively perfectly reasonable, but a tribunal disagrees and thinks there's a breach of the duty to make reasonable adjustments, because the duty to make reasonable adjustments is not subject to the range of reasonable responses test. It's an objective test decided by the tribunal, in theory, based on the facts known to the employer at the time. But of course, in the judicial process, it's very difficult not to use the benefit of hindsight. Let's turn to the third common situation, which is where the employee is no longer able to do their job. Example, Gareth. Gareth is employed as a postal delivery worker. He has an accident and he sustains a leg injury which meets the disability test. He can't walk far and he accepts he's unable to do the job for which he is employed. The implied requirement to be physically fit to do his delivery job is a PCP, a requirement of his employment. When he became disabled, that requirement to be physically fit placed him at a substantial disadvantage compared with non-disabled employees. The duty to make reasonable adjustments was triggered. Now, reasonable adjustments for Gareth will include looking for other suitable vacancies that he's physically able to do and to which he could be transferred. Provided Gareth has the required skills and is otherwise a suitable candidate, he should be offered an alternative position over other non-disabled candidates. Remember, the duty to make reasonable adjustments sometimes requires positive discrimination. But only reasonable steps are required. An employer won't be required, unless there are truly exceptional circumstances, to create a new role for Gareth where no suitable vacancy otherwise exists. In one case where creating a new role was found to be a reasonable adjustment, the employer was undertaking a reorganization and was found to have a blank sheet of paper in terms of roles within the organization. The change in role is, of course, a change to terms and conditions, though. So Gareth would have to agree to the new job before he could be transferred into it. Next, my four top tips for managing reasonable adjustments. Some absence or capability issues at work need expert help. Occupational health is a complex area where employers need clear guidance and medics who answer the questions that they've been asked. Dr. Joyshree Sarangi is an accredited specialist doctor who provides occupational health advice solutions for challenging work health problems. She can be contacted via www.coverclinic.com or by email via info@coverclinic.com. Here are my four top tips for managing reasonable adjustments. Number one, train managers to identify and action disability issues for new and existing staff. Number two, have a clear workplace policy for managers to follow to manage the reasonable adjustment process. Number three, engage with employees about reasonable adjustments. Ask an employee what they need. That's a strength, not a weakness. And number four, create a culture where difference is both accommodated and celebrated. Our differences can be our biggest strength. And that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Next week's episode is on the menopause and how employment law imposes certain obligations on employers and how best practice requires a whole lot more. I'll be discussing the topic of menopause next week with Amanda Stedman of BDBF Solicitors. I'm Barrister Daniel Barnett. If you don't already subscribe to Employment Law Matters or haven't left a review, please do. This is episode one of season three, and we've got nine more episodes coming up in this season, ranging from long COVID and occupational health through to a chat with a regional employment judge. Thank you for listening. Stay safe.
Any information on this podcast is for general guidance only. Always seek legal advice. Please see full terms at www.danielbarnett.co.uk/podcast-terms.